If you have your Bibles, look with me to Colossians chapter 3. We're bringing our five-part series to a close this morning. We're looking at verses 18 through 21 of chapter 3 in the book of Colossians. For those of you who are just joining us, let me bring you up to speed. I think I can do that in about a minute and a half, and we'll try to do that real quickly. In the first four verses, we hear Paul, who's giving us a guideline for living for Christ, say, if you have died to your sins and you have been resurrected with Christ, you've identified with His resurrection, you're a new creature in Christ. And so you need to elevate your thinking. Remember talking about that? And the way you do that is you stop thinking about things below, earthly things, temporal things, and you begin to think about eternal things and spiritual things, heavenly-minded things. You begin to see things the way God sees things, with a long perspective and not just the short period of time before us in this life. Well, as a result of doing that, he says, you're going to look at your life and you're going to see you've been walking by a philosophy that's common with people in the world, but that's not the way God intends for you to live. So look at your life and those things that are fleshly and temporal, those things that are carnal, you need to put those things to death. He uses that real strong word there, put those things to death. He's talking about immorality and greed and lying and slandering against one another. And then he says, as you take off these things, he compares it to a wardrobe. As you take off these things, there are certain things you ought to put on. And in week 3 and week 4, we talked about those things. He begins by telling us five things you need to put on. He says you need to put on heartfelt compassion and patience and grace and all those kind of things that reflect Christ's likeness. And then we saw last week you need to be accepting of each other. You need to forgive each other when you sin against each other. And the gospel needs to dwell in you richly so that whatever you do, you're doing all the glory of God in your sharing that in your everyday life. You're sharing it through song and through lessons. You're just all about the gospel, right? Well, where is he going to go today as he brings this to a close? He's talked about how you successfully live for Christ in the world and in church, but now he's going to turn and he's going to direct his focus in a very laser-like fashion to one particular area of our life. Here's how you live for Christ in the home. Now, to be honest with you, I'd never had this thought prior to this week in preparing for this message. It just occurred to me, and I've been preaching a long, long time, that we often say it's harder to live for Christ in the world than it is to live for Christ in church, and we would agree with that, right? And in the home. But can I tell you something as I begin to ponder this? I believe the truth of the matter is it's harder to live for Christ in your home, to be successful in living for Christ in your home, than it is for living for Christ in the church or in the world. And let me tell you why I think that. Most of us, when we're in the world, are aware we're in the world, and if we're professing Christians, if for no other reason, we worry about our witness because of our image. And there are certain things we won't do because we think it will reflect badly on us. But you know what I found about the home? The home is where we really and truly flesh out our lives and live our lives, and we let our hair down in our homes, right? The truth is, you'll do things in your home you wouldn't think about doing here at church. You'll do things in your home you wouldn't think about doing in a pagan office workplace, right? They see a side of you that no one else sees. They see you at your best and love you more than maybe anyone else. But I want to tell you something. In most of our homes, they see us at our worst, at our weakest, right? And we often hope and pray we're able, through relationship, to buy their silence. Aren't you glad your wife doesn't say everything about you she knows? Aren't you glad your husband, your kids, don't tell everything about you that they know? So the truth of the matter is, it's harder to live for Jesus in your home and be successful, good at it, than it is to live maybe even in the world. Do you know that every year, countless thousands of young people who have grown up in church and come every Sunday of their lives virtually, when they graduate from high school and they go off to college, they leave the church and they never ever return. That's sad, isn't it? And can I tell you, sometimes it's because of what they saw in church. Sometimes it's because of the influence of the world. But sometimes it's because they saw inconsistency in the home and they thought, this is all a big joke. When I first started pastoring, I was 22 years old, fresh out of college. I had gone to seminary, pastored a little small church of about 24 people. There was a lady in that church whose name I could call this morning, but I won't. She was a young lady, and she and her husband came and joined, and you could tell she was really struggling as a believer. One day she made an appointment to come see me. You know what the problem was? She grew up in a minister's home, and she would hear him preach the gospel on Sundays and tell about how God loved them and how we should demonstrate love and forgiveness. But the police would end up coming to her home about once a month because he would nail his wife to the wall or to the floor and beat her up. And those beatings, as she got over, spread over to her and her siblings. And when she was 17, she fled home and ran off to another state and soon thereafter was married. So Paul knows it's going to be hard to live for Christ successfully in the home. And he gives us some instruction. He also does this in Ephesians chapter 5, and you're probably more familiar with that passage. But notice what he says here in chapter 3, in verses 18, 19, and 20, and 21. And let me just say this. He's going to have four words of admonition. He's going to speak, first of all, to wives. And then he's going to turn and he's going to address husbands. And then he's going to address children. And then he's going to come back and talk to parents. Men and women in a home play a dual role. They play husband and wife role, but they also play the role of parent, right? And so he's going to end up talking to the parents. But notice what he says to wives in verse 18. Wives, be submissive to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. You know what he means by that expression, as is fitting in the Lord? In other words, this is right in the eyes of God. This is God's economy of things. This is God's plan for the home. God has a plan for His church. He has a plan for the world. He has a plan for the home. He says this is how God has ordained it, that it should be in the home, that wives should be submissive to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Now, before I tell you what that means, I want to hasten real quick before a bunch of women jump up and run out of the building. I want to tell you what it doesn't mean, okay? It doesn't mean that women are inferior to men. It doesn't mean or imply or suggest that women are not as smart as men. In fact, most of us, if we're honest, would argue to the contrary, right? It doesn't mean that women are less moral than men. And I don't know about you, but I just got to be honest. I don't understand it, but it seems the way that women are made, their being, the way they're raised, women are more moral in most cases than men. That's what's pretty staggering right now, in my opinion, about what I see going on in the world, because oftentimes some of the worst language I hear in the marketplace is coming out of the mouths of women. It seems so different and contrary to everything I know about women. Women typically are more moral than men, right? So he's not saying they're less intelligent. He's not saying they're less moral, they're less discerning, or they're less able. Let me tell you something. He's also not saying they're less strong emotionally. Don't get that idea. I've heard guys say, well, you know, men are these macho guys and they just don't have any emotions and women are weak and they're always crying. That's not what he's saying at all. So what is he saying? What he is saying is this. Her goal as a wife is to support her husband. The role of the wife in God's plan of things is this. That she has a very meaningful role, but that role is to be a supportive role. It is to be in support of her husband. Basically, it's this. She's to make her husband successful. She recognizes for the good of her home, for the good of her children, for the good of her marriage, that she's in the role of being submissive, and her goal is to make him the most successful husband he can possibly be. She does that by praying for him and encouraging him and bragging on him and supporting him and following his lead and advising him. It doesn't mean that she's this quiet person who sits there idly by and says, "What do you want me to do next?" But rather, she's his chief supporter. She's behind him. And she's advising him, and she's honestly telling him how she feels so he'll know how she feels about a given situation and can take that into account. She's building him up. And believe me, in this role, she has a powerful influence on not only her husband, but also on her children. Submission isn't easy, but it is extremely gratifying. When you do the job right, as being a submissive wife, it is extremely gratifying. It is not a second-class job. How many of you watch politics, at least on election day, right? You're forced to sit before the campaign. But on election night, I always enjoy watching the returns. The first half of the show is pretty much NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN, whoever, Fox. They project this person the winner, right? And they're giving the numbers. And then when they start coming in and saying, "Here's who's won," they flash over to the hotels where the campaign headquarters is, right? The candidates are never to be found. They're off in some hotel room, and they're watching the results to see if they've won or they've lost. But the people on the floor, guess who they are? They are people who have been supporters. They've been in that submissive role. They've been out there beating the drum and praying for this person and putting out his posters and speaking well of him and building him up and doing all the legwork, right? But you watch those campaigns, and when they come out and they say, "We project so-and-so is the winner," or "So-and-so is the loser," and the loser comes out on stage and he makes that concession speech, how do those workers feel? Boy, you can look in their faces and tell they're in a state of real mourning because they've invested their soul and their life in this person. They've given months and months and months and lots of dollars and time and energy, and they feel that loss personally. In fact, you've seen this when they start to speak. Sometimes they'll say, "No, no, don't concede. It's too early," right? But what about in the other camp where that guy has pulled it off and he's won? Boy, there is so much jubilation, and they're just excited, and there's a party atmosphere. And they act almost as if they had won. They're not going to go to the White House. They're not going to be in the Congress. But they feel as though they have won because they've been in that supportive role. I'm telling you, it is a great honor to be a wife in a home, in a Christian home, and to be supportive of her husband if you understand what that really involves, that you're there, you're his right-hand man. You're the one who's advising him and who's keeping him on target and who's keeping him straight morally and spiritually. And you're praying for him. And you're the one who's responsible for his success. And he knows it and you know it as well. But it requires discipline. And you know why it requires discipline? I'm just going to speak real frankly here. You know why it requires discipline for a wife to be submissive to her husband? Because a lot of times she knows and recognizes, as well as he does if he's honest, she's smarter than I am. She's right more often than I am. She's a better person. She's more godly than I am. She's a better example to our kids than I am. But I'm going to tell you something. He's still in that role of the husband. And there's nothing he can do to abandon that role. Nothing he can do to walk away from that role. That's the role God's put him in. And hers is to be supportive of him. And in spite of his stupidity sometimes, to help make him successful. You understand that? That's the role of the wife in the home. Let me just ask you before I press on to the second point. Husbands, do any of you, I know some of you are thinking, "Boy, I'm glad he's preaching this today." Boy, my wife, she needs to hear this. She needs to get a dose of this. Is your wife submissive? Let me just tell you something, husbands. If she's not, it may be your fault. If she's not submissive, if she's not on your team and she's not pulling for you and she's not submitting herself willfully, deliberately, intentionally submitting herself to you and letting you lead, I'm telling you, it may not be altogether her fault. It may be your fault, as you'll see in just a moment. Notice what he says to husbands. Look at verse 19. "Husbands, love your wives and don't be bitter against them. It means don't be cross with them. Don't be angry with them. Don't be put out with them. Husbands, love your wives. Boy, we're a little surprised to hear him say, wives, submit to your husbands. Play the support role. That's challenging. But when he comes to husbands, he says, husbands, love your wives. And you think, really? I mean, that's all you got for these guys is love your wives? Wouldn't they naturally love their wife? Why would they have married them if they didn't love their wife? You got to understand this. Paul is speaking to a world where women are seen as possessions. They're seen as little more than property at times, in biblical times. I tell you what to do, you do it. You see it in many Old Testament stories. There's not the regard for women that there is for men. So Paul says, love your wives. Don't be bitter toward your wives. Can I tell you something? In some places today, even though times have changed, legalities have changed, there are some men, and I find them occasionally even in the church, who still think of their wives as their property. You will do as I say to do. They think that's what being submissive is. I'll tell you what to do and you'll jump and ask how high. You'll follow my lead. You'll follow my orders, my instructions. You can't talk back. You can't say anything. And at times, because men are typically stronger and bigger, they sometimes use their strength and their physical size to impose their will on their wives. You know what I'm talking about, right? All man has to do is just jump up, and typically they tower over their wife. Not always, but 99% of the time. They're stronger physically than their wives. They can just look. They can turn quickly. And they can impose their will on their children and on their wives if they're not careful. But I want to tell you something, wives. If you have a husband who is abusing you physically, get out. You don't have to take that. That's not God's plan for your life. He didn't intend for you to be a punching bag. And if he's abusing you, you need to walk. You need to call the sheriff's department. You need to get out of that situation, and you need to do it immediately. No woman should subject herself or her children to physical abuse. And men, you will never win the hearts of your wife and children by physically imposing your will on them. Let me tell you what will happen. The opposite will happen. They may do what you say in your presence, but they will hate you and they will despise you. And when the time is right and they can, they will flee from you. You never get somebody to be loyal to you and to pull for you and to be anything other than a gopher and a servant when you try to impose physically your will on them, or even mentally impose your will on them. How many of you saw Whoopi Goldberg's movie years and years ago? It was called, let me find it here in my notes, Kingdom Come. Didn't you see that movie? Anybody here see it? Am I the only one that saw it? I think I am. I'm the only one I see. Regina? We're the only two. Whoopi Goldberg was in this movie where she's married to this guy. She's sitting across the table. It's been years since I've seen it, so if I don't get all of it right, of course, you won't know it anyway. But I'll just make it up, okay? She's seated across this guy at the breakfast table, her husband. They've been married many, many years. They're up in age now. And they're sitting there eating their breakfast. They're not saying a word. They're just eating. It seems strange as you watch the movie because there's just no conversation. She's here. He's there. They're eating. And just all of a sudden, he looks up and, boom, his face plants in his bacon and eggs, right? He just dies. She looks over at him. He's dead. She calls, I can't remember now if it was the ambulance or she calls the funeral home, but someone comes and they take his body out. They begin notifying children. The children come. She's not showing much emotion at all. The children get there and for a day or two, they're mourning. They know the kind of guy he is. She's still not indicating anything emotionally at all. Finally, they're making arrangements for the funeral, and the son comes to her and he says, well, Mom, we've got to pick out a headstone, and they need to know what you want on the headstone. What do you want me to tell them to put on the headstone? And for one of the first times in the movie, she says something meaningful. She looks at him and says, I want you to tell him to put on the headstone, he was mean and surly. And the son says, Mom, we can't say that. She says, you asked me, that's what I want to put on the tombstone. He was mean and surly. I wonder if our kids and wives put on our tombstones, men, when we die, not what they think the community needs to see in us, but what they really feel in their hearts, what they would put on those tombstones. I got a feeling some of them might just say, he was mean and surly. He was just bullheaded. He showed very little patience. He was just oppressive. What would they say about you? If you want your wife to be submissive, you know how you do that? Paul goes on to say something in the Ephesian passage that parallels this third chapter of Colossians, and this is what he says. He says, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. You know what he means? To love them sacrificially. The wife has a huge job, but I'm going to tell you something. In my estimation, the husband has a more difficult role than even the wife. Because if he does it the way God intends for him to do it, he's not this dictator who's saying to his wife and kids, follow me, I'm the leader, I'm going to call all the shots. He's a guy who's feeling out his wife and his children, and he's thinking about what really in their lives they do need. And he's the one, when it comes to making a sacrifice, it's on him. And his wife and his kids will follow him. You know why? Because they know, Daddy, my husband is never going to be thinking of himself. He's not selfish. If it comes to making a sacrifice, he's going to be the one to make the sacrifice. And I want to tell you something. Even when he messes it up, you'll follow a guy like that. Because you know, he has your best interest. He may get it wrong. He may not always know the right thing to do. But he's going to do what he thinks is best for his wife and his kids. He's sacrificial. Well, thirdly, notice what he says to children. Because I want to tell you something. I wish we had all those kids in here before. Because I want to tell you something. In a happy home, children play a major role. Do you know that? Your family is not going to be happy if the kids are not playing their role. If they're not doing what God intends for them to do, you can have a good husband, good wife, but the kids are not listening to God and obeying God, it's going to be a mess. Listen to what he says in verse 20. Children, obey your parents in everything, for this is pleasing in the Lord. First thing I want you to see is this, guys, if you're hearing a kid, it's pleasing to God. It's what God expects of you. It's what God wants of you. You don't realize it right now. You're living your lives. You're fleshing out your lives just like your parents. But I want to tell you something. You're in a stage of life where you're in a training ground. You're training to be a husband. You're training to be a wife. You're training to be a school teacher. You're training to be an adult. And one of the lessons that God needs for you to learn, if you're going to be successful in this world and successful in His kingdom, you've got to learn how to deal with authority. And one of the things you've got to do is you've got to learn how to submit yourself to authority and obey authority. Because I'm going to tell you something. If you can't master that, if you can't learn to deal with authority, boy, you're going to have a hard time in life. You're going to have a hard time in high school. You're going to have a hard time in middle school. You're going to have a hard time in college. You're going to have a hard time in the workforce. If you can't learn to deal with authority. I've got a couple of seminary degrees, couple college degrees, but I'm going to tell you something. The best education I ever got was when I worked for Bill Connor at First Baptist Church in Mount Pleasant, and he was the senior pastor, and I was the associate pastor, youth director. It was more valuable to my ministry over time than any of those educational processes through which I went, because I learned he's an authority, and I'm going to submit to his authority. When I think he's right and when I think he's wrong, I'm going to follow him. And when you learn to submit to authority, I want to tell you something, you'll learn how to be in authority. And you can't learn how to be in authority unless you have been under authority. So he says, Submit yourself to your parents. Obey your parents in everything, for this is right. There's another reason he wants you to do that. You know why? You're learning about spiritual authority by being under the physical authority of your parents. How in the world, I want you to listen to this, how in the world can you obey God who you have not seen if you can't obey your mom and dad who are sitting right there in the kitchen with you? If I can look at them and hear their instruction and I can't get that down and do what they tell me to do, how in the world am I ever going to listen to God who I can't even see? And then there's the second thing in that, and this is the real kicker. Obey in everything. Now that's what trips us up, isn't it? Do you have trouble obeying your parents when they tell you what you want to hear? I never did. My dad ever said to me, "You can stay out to midnight." "Okay, Dad, I can do that." "You can go to this place you want to go." "Okay, Dad, I'll do that if that's what you want me to do." I don't have any problem doing anything anybody tells me that I want to do. It's when I don't want to do it, but he says do it. It's when he forbids me from doing something and I want to do it. That's when I have trouble obeying. But Paul says obey them in everything, that which you want to do and that which you don't want to do. Does it mean I have to like it? No. Does it mean I have to agree with it? Does it mean I have to think he's the smartest man in the world? I'm sure glad he kept me from doing what I wanted to do. No. But I've got to submit to his authority. I've got to obey him or there's going to be difficulty in the home. Now I'm going to just throw this in for free because this is one of my pet peeves, okay? You know what I really hate? I hate it when kids go off to camp. They stay a week. Their parents have sent them there, paid a lot of money to send them to camp. They go to camp. They have a great week. They come back. Boy, teenagers, when they go to camp, they've had a great time. You can always tell, right? Because they're hugging, right? They're just, "Oh, I just love you, and I love you, and I love you, and I love you." And we're all loving each other, singing Kumbaya. "Oh, man, it's so great to be a believer. I just love it, love it, love it, love it. It's so great. I just so love God. I went off to that camp, and they told me about God, and boy, God is in my life now, and I just love God, love God, love God." And then the service ends on Sunday night. We've gotten a report from them, and now we're heading out the door. And I overhear a teen talking with their parents, and they say, "Hey, Mom, Dad, a bunch of us are going down to so-and-so's, and we're going to hang out there for a while, and we'll be home by 10:30, 11 o'clock. And the mom says, "Man, I love that testimony." The dad says, "I love that testimony, what you shared tonight from the pulpit. That was so great. I'm so glad about your spiritual decision. But you know what? You've been gone all weekend. And tomorrow's a school night. And if you don't mind, how about going home with us tonight? And you can do that another time." You know, I've seen some of these missionary wannabes just turn and say, "What? So-and-so's mama's letting them go. You just always rain on my parade. You treat me like I'm 6 years old." What's amazing how you can go from just being so spirit-filled to being so ungodly. Don't tell me how much you love Jesus if you're not obeying your mom and dad. That's a joke. Do you understand that? It's a joke if you're not obeying what your folks tell you to do. Finally, a word to fathers, and I close. Verse 21, and I think this is to fathers and mothers, not just fathers. "Fathers, do not exasperate your children so that they won't become discouraged." I love that word, exasperate. I actually hate it, but I like it in the sense of it being a strong word. It paints such a clear picture. You know what it means to exasperate somebody? My kids will not believe I'm about to do this. In fact, I just had this idea, so I'm going to do it right now. I never let anybody touch my hair. I'm just particular about my hair, right? But this is what to exasperate means. It means to go, See, I want to get it back in place even now, right? But that's what it, have you ever had that feeling? Somebody's talking to you, and they're 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 talking to you. And after you do, shut up. Stop it. You're driving me crazy. You're driving me insane. That's what he means. That's as clear as I know to put it. That's what it means to exasperate somebody. So he says, Fathers, do not exasperate your children so they won't become discouraged. It's your job to teach them, to love them, to protect them. But in doing that, don't make them crazy. Don't make them crazy. Don't make them nuts. Don't make them want to scream. I'm going to share with you four quick tips. I mean, just one, two, three, four, real quickly. Here they are. You ready? Don't set the bar so high they can't succeed. I've seen parents exasperate kids because they just put the bar way up here. And there's no way in the world that kid's going to get over that bar. So you know what? He's doomed before he starts. When I was in seminary, I was working on a doctorate. They sent me to Bowman Gray School of Medicine to take a thing called CPE. In CPE, there are 8 or 9 ministers. I'm 30. There's an older guy. I'm the youngest guy in the room. And there's a guy there about 60 years old. He's a Lutheran minister. We take a time once a week, and they have IPR, interpersonal relationships. And you go around this room, and somebody's on the hot seat today, and next week somebody else is going to be on the hot seat. And you tell them about your childhood and what was good and what was bad. And this guy, this Lutheran minister, 60 years old, is on the hot seat today, and he's sitting over there, and I'm sitting opposite him just watching him. And he doesn't even know it, but as he's sitting there telling us, we're all in these seats, he takes his left leg and he pulls it up to the seat. And he takes his right leg and he puts it up on the seat. And he takes his arms and he embraces his knees. And he doesn't even know it. He's just telling us his story, but he's in a fetal position. And he begins telling us about when he's a 9-year-old kid and he and his dad are cutting wood. And they had one of those old cross-cut saws. You ever use one of those? Boy, they're hard to use. Because if you're coming this way, you're just pulling, but you can't push it. You're just kind of guiding it when you're going back the other way. They're hard for adults to learn how to use. And this guy was telling about using that cross-cut saw with his dad, and he said that thing would bow every now and then. And he says his dad first would yell at him and say, "Would you not get it right, Clyde? Stop it, Clyde. You're stupid. What are you doing?" Said after a while, he'd pick up a stick and he'd just throw that little piece of firewood at him. He would flinch. I'm going to tell you something. Those negative messages that you send to your child, they'll forget a lot of things you say to them. They'll never forget that stuff. That's going to be the tape they're going to play over and over and over and over and over in their head. I don't want them out to anything. I'm no good for nothing. I'm stupid. I'm lazy. Don't set the bar too high. Let them have emotions and opinions. Now, please hear what I'm saying, because I see a lot of parents who make this mistake. They think it's talking back if you tell me your opinion. Now, you ought to tell me your opinion in a civil fashion. But I'm going to tell you something. We do our children a disjustice, an injustice, if we don't allow them to have an opinion. They don't have to always agree with you. It should be okay for you to turn to your child and say, "I know you didn't want to do this. How do you feel about this?" And they tell you. And so long as they don't get disrespectful, and disagreeing with you is not being disrespectful. Say, "I just don't see the need for this, Dad, but if it's what you want me to do, I'll do it. But I don't agree with this. I think you're missing the mark on this. I think you're wrong." But I'm going to tell you, there'll be less anger there where you allow them to have emotions, where you allow them to have feelings and express to you their opinions. Thirdly, learn, and this is a big one, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, use crude language, but I just so want you to get this. It's the best way I know to do it. Learn, if you're a parent, to shut up. Learn that sometimes, in fact, all the time, fewer words are more effective than more words. Less is more. Less is more. I've seen parents who just go on and on and on and on ad nauseum and leave a room and come back in 10 minutes later and pick up right where they left off. Or bring up tomorrow what was yesterday's business. My mother was a great parent. She had 2 great gifts. One was the gift of encouragement. I'm going to tell you something. If I never did anything, it wasn't because she didn't tell me I couldn't. She was constantly saying, "You can do anything." And I'll tell you the second thing about my mama, so great. She knew when to be quiet. She would correct you, she would tell you, and she would be quiet. And you didn't have to hear it over and over and over. Because I'm going to tell you something, when you hear it over and over and over, we do that as parents because we think they didn't hear me. I got to make sure they hear me. I'm going to tell you something. The more you talk, the less they hear. Remember what Proverbs says? He says to husbands, he says, boy, there's nothing worse than a nagging wife. She's like a leaky faucet. She's like a water falling off, dripping off a roof. It's kasplat, 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 kasplat. After a while, you're going, stop, stop. Finally, don't tease, taunt, or compare them to others. Don't belittle them. I close by telling you this. Happy homes are homes where every person in the family recognizes they play a part, they have a role in the collective happiness of the family. And because of that, they're doing their part. It means this. Husbands are being husbands. And wives are being wives. And kids are being obedient and helpful. And parents, they recognize these little guys underneath them. They don't know everything. They're learning the ropes. They're going to make some mistakes. They're going to correct them and discipline them. But most of all, they're going to encourage them and love them and strengthen them. And they're working as a family unit. Now, can I ask you, as I bring this all to a close, are you doing your part? I want every man in the room who's a husband today to ask you, am I that sacrificial, loving husband that I should be? Am I that parent who's understanding and I'm herding them in the right direction, but man, I'm not breaking their spirit? Or is there something about that that I need to change? Wives, are you supporting your husband? Are you building them up? Are you encouraging them? Are you the best cheerleader they have? Or do you just constantly find fault with them and pick them apart and can't ever be happy about anything? Kids, are you obeying your folks? I mean, if Jason saw you at home and saw how you respond to your parents, would he think you're as great a Christian as he thinks right now? And parents, are you browbeating your kids and just riding them hard and thinking that's going to let them turn out where you want them to turn out? Because I'm going to tell you something, it won't. It just won't. We're going to have a hymn of invitation, and I hope you're bold enough and love your family enough today that you won't care, listen to me as I close, no one move, that you won't care who sees you or what anyone thinks of you or what they'll assume your problem is, but that you'll love your wife and husband and child enough and love your parents enough that some of you will get up and come to this altar and just kneel here and say, God, make me what I need to be. And some of you will maybe even turn to each other, either during this service or after the service. Would you forgive me? When I hadn't been the husband I need to be, or the wife I need to be, or the young kid I need to be. Let's pray together. Lord, I pray even now your spirit would fall in this place and speak to our hearts and draw us, Lord, to make decisions that will make a difference in our home. It'll make a difference in our lives and our testimony. Let us not be people, Lord, who know how to live successfully in the world and know how to live in church, but then can't live at home. I pray, Lord, that we be genuine, authentic in our faith. Have your will and way in this service today. For we make this prayer in Jesus' name, and for his sake we humbly pray. Amen. You stand as we come and sing.